This is KLLG, LP 97.9 FM, Willits, California. I'm Greg Schindel, train singer. We are now boarding the Bipolar Express.
Chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga up the hill. Puffin' and a-chuggin', you know that engine will reach the summit and go down the other side. Whoopee! What a ride! Clickety-clackety-clickety-clackety-click. Look at the engine, that's old 45. Fired up and ready, she seems to come alive. Listen to that wailing whistle all round the countryside. Whoopee! What a ride! Clickety-clackety-clickety-clackety-click. Up the grade she goes. Woo! The wheels are slipping. Up the grade she goes until we reach the summit and go down the other side. Whoopee! What a ride! Clickety-clackety-clickety-clackety-click.
Whoopee! Yes, I know. What a ride. What a ride it was in 2018. And now we have arrived in 2019. Can you believe this? Woo! Hey, you know, Christmas celebrations with the traditional songs and decorations of light, they're now being replaced by the natural returning sunlight day by day as we spin and revolve toward, yes, the spring equinox. I'm one of those guys looking forward to that. Little violets poking their heads and the daffodils shouting out the new world. Anyway, however, meanwhile, I guess we're going to settle back into the staying warm and healthy during the coming cold, windy weeks of winter. You know, I heard Mike Burgess, who's in the studio today doing all the engineering, he had 14 degrees on his compost pile the other morning. So that's not right. That's not right, Mike. Succulents don't do well in that kind of environment.
No.
Please. Well, Greg. Oh, well, Greg, as train singer, the month of December was all about Christmas, whether it be on the magical Christmas train, singing about Rudolph and Frosty and, oh yes, Skippy the train deer on the skunk train, or in church, singing about joy to the world. you know, train singer, I've been there right along with you. But anyway, happy new year to you, train singer.
Whoa. Happy New Year and happy music and fun and for me, too. That's Greg Schindel talking.
You know, we both wish everyone on the planet at this time a new year of, improving health, unexpected windfalls, progress and rewards in new endeavors and enterprises, and a warm and peaceful place to stay. Well, this is Greg Schindel, train singer. We are riding on the Bipolar Express on KLLG LP 97.9 FM, Willits, California. Hey, now, we can look ahead to the new year with hope and dreams. However, it sure is a lot easier to look back and reflect on last year's 2018 with experience. Now for Christmas, I received the book Black Bart Boulevardier Bandit. And a boulevardier is a French word. It kind of means the man about town, kind of a classy guy with a nice outfit, and as he was in San Francisco. But around here, how many of you out there in the listening world have heard of Black Bart? Yeah, that's right. Yes, there's Mike's raising his hand. By gosh, Black Bart. He's on Matchbook covers. By gosh, this Black Bart Casino, and of course, our own Mike Burgess here at KLLG. He is an active Black Bart member. His handle being Dr. Lefty. Ooh, yeah, he cuts with the right and reaches in with the left. Right? Is that it? Something like that?
Yeah.
Ooh, it's kind of creepy, but my wife and I were in the Black Bart, and my son and daughter were also in the Gunfighters. I won't remember what my can't remember August or Malachi's handle, but mine was Railroad Bill, and my wife's name was Dawn Star, and we had some really good times with that club. But back to Black Bart here. It was Black Bart. Actually, I was Black Bart at my son's wedding. I showed up with the derby and the cane and the black vest. But I ended up being called Dapper Dan or Debonair Dan. Well, after all. All right, okay. Now, you know, this outlaw style of the 1800s, 1870s and 80s was certainly a part of Mendocino, as Black Bart struck just 2 miles outside of Little Lake. So I'd like to pass on some of Northern California outlaw nature up here and read a little bit about a local legend, Black Bart. So let's begin with this wonderful book that I got for Christmas. Few Western outlaws, with the possible exception of Jesse James, Butch Cassidy, or somewhat mythical Joaquin Murrieta, stirred the public's imagination, as did stage robber Black Bart, the P-O-8. That's like poet. Unlike others whose names have become Western legend, Black Bart headed no bandit gang. Instead, for 8 years, he led a solitary life of outlawry, operating strictly alone. Other famous outlaws, or at least members of their gangs, left behind them a trail of innocent blood. Black Bart, during his career, which involved a string of 28 stage robberies, never fired a shot in anger or injured a single victim. My, now that's really something I have to say. Well, this is from the beginning of Black Bart, Boulevardier Bandit. The scent of oak leaves and dry grass mingled with the pungent smell of horse sweat and powdery red dust as the Sonora Milton stage toiled up the steep Funk Hill grade that morning of July 26, 1875. The sun warm on his back, stage driver John Shine reclined in his seat, lines loose in his hands and relaxed for the first time since leaving Sonora 3 hours earlier. The worst of the trip, the steepest and most winding, down to Reynolds Ferry in the Stanislaus River Canyon, was behind him. In another hour, he would be pulling into the mining town of Copperopolis, and by lunchtime, he would be unloading at the railroad depot in Milton. The stage, a mud wagon. These mud wagons, by the way, they had wider wheels than the standard big ones, and they were used better on these muddy, old, dusty roads in Mendocino, for example. Anyway, was carrying 10 passengers, 8 women and children, and 2 men, one of whom was John Olive, owner of the stage line. As usual, it carried a U.S. mail pouch and a Wells Fargo and Company express box. But on this occasion, the box contained no gold bullion and less than $300 in gold notes. Because of the low value of the shipment, Wells Fargo had not provided the usual messenger. That's a shotgun guard. That, too, was out of the ordinary, for the stagecoaches on the Sonora-Milton run, particularly on the portion lying in Calaveras County, which followed the Reynolds Ferry Road, had Oh, my goodness. They had become favorite victims of highwaymen. Ooh, boy. Stages on that run had been robbed 4 times in the past 4 years, and 2 of those had occurred within the past 4 months. On March 1 and March 23rd, the last netted 3 gunmen more than $6,500. Big money back in 1875. Now, the stage was nearing the top of Funk Hill at the head of the Yaqui Gulch when suddenly a masked gunman brandishing a shotgun leaped from behind a boulder into the middle of the road, directly in front of the horses. As Shine struggled to control his frightened team, the bandit, his head covered by a flour sack mask, leveled the shotgun. In a firm, distinctive voice, he called out, Please throw down the box. Now, John Shine was a brave man, but he was no fool. Unarmed and looking down the wrong end of a double-barrel shotgun, well, he had little choice but to obey the order. But it was not easy to lift that somewhat bulky, iron-bound Wells Fargo box with one hand while holding the reins with the other. Well, when Shine momentarily hesitated while trying to grasp the box, the gunman, still standing in the road, glanced toward the boulder-strewn hillside and shouted, "If he makes a move, give him a volley, boys!" And from the corner of his eye, as he lifted the heavy express box to toss it over the side, Shine saw what appeared to be gun barrels pointed at him from behind a rocky outcropping on the uphill side of the road. Now, passenger John Olive, a young Sonova miner next to him, and several women passengers poked their heads through the stagecoach windows to see what was happening. And at the sight of the armed man, the women withdrew from the windows with squawks and surprise. Now, from a holster at his waist, the young miner whipped out a long-barreled revolver. But before he could raise the gun, Olive grabbed his wrist and shoved the weapon toward the floor.
"Put that damn thing away! Do you want to get us all killed?"
he ordered in a loud stage whisper. Well, the box landed with a thump on the edge of the dusty road, and as it did, one of the now thoroughly frightened women beside the stage reached out of the window and dropped her purse on the ground. With his shotgun still aimed at the stage driver, the bandit walked forward, picked up the purse, and with a courteous bow, dropped it back into the coach. "I don't want your money, only the express box and mail." Then, with a sweep of his hand, he motioned John Shine to drive on up the hill. And Shine, as he pulled away, chanced to glance backward and saw the bandit already attacking the express box with a hatchet. Shine's stage had hardly disappeared up the grade when a second stagecoach, driven by Donald McLean of Sonora, rounded a curve and came upon the masked man still laboring with the hatchet to open the express box. An instant later, McLean and his several passengers found themselves confronted by the business end of the shotgun. "Please throw down the box," the masked gunman requested. But the stage was allowed to pass undisturbed after McLean informed the bandit he was carrying no treasure. The road agent made no attempt to rob McLean or his passengers of their personal funds. And at the top of the hill, McLean's stage caught up with Shine's, and there both halted, while the drivers, accompanied by several male passengers, walked back to where they could view the robbery scene. And as they drew close enough to clearly see the boulder behind which the robber had been hiding, they were shocked to find the rifle barrels they had seen pointing at them were nothing more than sticks, which had been carefully arranged to look like guns. with their empty express box and the mail sacks and the bandit had cut open, Shine hurriedly completed the trip to Copperopolis, where he reported the robbery to Wells Fargo agent J.M. Pike, and Pike immediately sent a telegram to Sandra Andreas, the county seat, to notify Calaveras County Sheriff Benjamin Thorne, while Shine continued his trip to Milton. Now, I want to say that Sheriff Tom reached that robbery scene that afternoon, but found little to provide him or Wells Fargo Chief of Detectives James B. Hume with any solid clues. They found a trampled spot behind a large boulder on the hillside of the road, where the gunman had apparently waited in concealment for arrival of the stage. And in the road they found his boot marks and where he had kneeled in the dust to squash the express box with the hatchet. Behind the rock over the bandit had arranged sticks to look like gun barrels. Thorne found a real 12-gauge shotgun buried in the leaves. Now, whether the gun was a second one, which the bandit, for some reason, had brought to the robbery scene, or was the gun he had used in the robbery and then buried, they didn't know. Some of the passengers who'd been on the stage and had seen the robber said that in addition to the shotgun, which he pointed at the stage driver, he also carried a Henry rifle slung over his shoulder on a strap. Now, if he was carrying a rifle, it was one of the few times during his 8-year robbery career that he was armed with anything but a shotgun. Now, I'd like to take it this time. This is Greg Schindel reading and Train Singers listening avidly from inside. We're talking about Black Bart, the Boulevardier, that's hard to say, bandit, on KLLG 97.9 FM. Well, that's California. Right. Hey. And we are in the outlaw mode today. Jeez, I was watching. I got to say, I'll talk about that a little later. So, Thorne and Hume, they noted the shotgun unloaded but in good working condition was a breech-loading side hammer 12-gauge and with its twin barrel shortened to something less than 24 inches. Hey, at close range, a gun of that type, loaded with buckshot, that'd throw a formidable pattern. Though the officers surmised that the bandit, if also armed with a repeating rifle, chose to leave the shotgun behind rather than be encumbered with a second weapon during the flight through the mountainous terrain. But, you know, except for the shotgun, they came away from the robbery site with no more clues than useful information on the holdup than they had arrived with. Nevertheless, within the week, Wells Fargo circulated a poster dated July 27, 1875, listing details of the robbery. The reward offered was, more than the amount the company reported losing to the gunman. How much the bandit may have found in the mail sacks, now that was never ascertained. But the poster inspired the Wells Fargo stated, "Reward! Wells Fargo and Company's express box containing $160 in gold notes was robbed this morning by one man on the route from Sonora to Milton near the top of the hill between the river and Copperopolis. $250 and 1/4 of any money recovered will be paid for the arrest and conviction of the robber." And it was posted. And they hunted him, but they just couldn't. I couldn't find anything about it. You know, and following the July 26 Sonora Milton robbery, this bandit simply dropped out of sight because no one had seen his face and, well, there's no way of tracing or identifying him. And he was not heard of again until almost the end of the year. Then, on the cold, wintry morning of December 28th, in the digger pine and scrub oak-covered foothills a few miles north of Smartsville in Nevada County, the flour sack masked bandit, shotgun in hand, halted the North San Juan Marysville stage driven by Mike Hogan. It was the second time in 2 weeks that Hogan's stage had been robbed on this run. Angered by his ill luck, Hogan nevertheless prudently complied with the gunman, motioning at him with the gaping twin-barreled shotgun barrels, politely instructed him in a deep, authoritarian voice to toss down the mail sacks and Wells Fargo box. Hogan and an unidentified passenger later said they thought a second man was involved because they saw a gun barrel protruding from behind a log at the edge of the road. What they probably observed, said Wells Fargo Detective James Hume, was a stick arranged to look like a gun, the same ruse used by the bandit during the July 26 robbery on Funk Hill. While Hogan hurried his team to Marysville, gathered a posse, and was back at the robbery scene in less than 4 hours, but except for the smashed express box, which, according to the Marysville newspaper, had yielded only a few hundred dollars, they could pick up no trace of the stage robber or clues to his identity. The mail sacks, which had contained an undetermined amount, had been slashed from top to bottom to form an inverted T, a unique slit that was to become very well known to Jim Hughes over the Hume over the ensuing years. Yeah, I noticed that. As we read through this, he cuts the bags in a certain way to get the mail out efficiently, and that becomes one of his trademarks. So they were able to kind of say, maybe it's the same guy. Well, apparently the bandit had fled the robbery scene on foot. And rain, which had begun falling later in the day, aided his escape by washing out his tracks. This job, said Hume in grudgingly admiration, is the work of a professional. Now, more than 6 months elapsed before the flour sacked. Masked bandits struck again. Then, on the night of June 2nd, 1876, some 5 miles north of Cottonwood, about 4 miles below Oregon-California state line, he robbed the Roseburg, Oregon, Wairika stage of express box and, yes, mail sack. His tactics were generally the same, but this robbery also marked the start of the bandit's use of darkness to help shield his operations. In fact, Black Bart was one of the few highwaymen who committed stage robberies at night. Imagine that. On this moonlit night, stage driver A.C. Adams' six-horse team was traveling slowly up a steep rise when, from the shadows, a man stepped in front of the horses and ordered Adams to stop. Now, aided by the moonlight and the dim glow of the stage lamps, Adams could see that the man was holding a gun and was wearing what appeared to be a sack over his head. Exhibiting his usual firm courtesy, the masked man demanded the express box and mail pouches. When Adams hesitated, the bandit raised his gun threateningly. The entire episode lasted only minutes. Although there were several passengers aboard the stage, no effort was made to rob them. Well, when he finally arrived in Cottonwood, Adams reported the robbery. But because of darkness, pursuit could not be undertaken until morning. At daybreak, a passenger found the smashed express box lying beside the road where the robbery took place. Again, the mail sacks had been opened with the now too familiar slit. Deputy Sheriff John Halleck arrived later in the morning to take up the stage robber's trail. But other than some boot tracks in the road, he found no clues. The tracks pointed east toward a promontory in the Siskiyou Mountains, the locals called Pilot Rock. Pilot Rock was used as a landmark by early travelers between Roseburg and Wairika when the route was only a dimly marked trail. Imagine that. Now the earth was dry and hard, making the tracking difficult. And before the day was out, the trail was again lost. Now, James Hughes, he arrived from San Francisco, and he made inquiries and announced that his company was offering $250 for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the stage robber. Why, the state of California Shortly thereafter, sweetened the reward part with another $300. The offers brought forth no information, and as now is becoming more common, Wells Fargo officials declined to disclose their company's loss. Many felt that to admit a large take by bandits in a single holdup would only encourage other outlaws to try their luck at Wells Fargo's expense. In fact, it was the practice of James Humes and the Wells Fargo General Superintendent, John J. Valentine, to play down their company's losses to banditry. Quite possibly the flour sack mass bandit take in the Roseburg-Wairika robbery was substantial, for that was his only known activity for the year 1876. In fact, it was more than a year before he struck again. Hey, listeners out there, you outlaws and you wannabe outlaws, we are reading about Black Bart, our local legend right here in Willits. And I'm Greg Schindel, and listening for me, maybe Train Singer will read some of this in his different voice, I don't know. We're riding the Bipolar Express on KLLG, LP 97.9, right here in Willits, California, right here in outlaw land. Whoa, was that a shot? Yeah, right. Okay. Hey, if the man who was soon to become known as Black Bart did not overwork himself in the stage robbery business that year, there were plenty of others who kept the trade flourishing. In fact, stage robbery became so prevalent at the Reading-Wairika area that year's end, some local citizens were suggested federal protection. Now, let me move on here. Oh, yes. Here we go again. The Reading-Wairika robberies finally tapered off as some of the criminal element ran afoul of the law, and others, possibly seeking more lucrative fields, moved on. But on August 3rd, 1877, the flour sack masked bandit robbed a stage near the Russian River on the Point Arena Duncan Mills Run. And from that day, he was no longer nameless. From the express box, the bandit took $300 in coin and a check for $302.52, written on the Granger's Bank of San Francisco. By the way, it was never cashed. The stage, driven by Ash Wilkinson, left Point Arena at 6 a.m. with seven passengers for the 55-mile trip to Duncan Mills. Boy, that must have been something, Mike. Jeez, 55 miles in those.
Bouncing on that road.
Oh, mud wagons. Well, it was not a journey to be awaited with anticipation, for sure. The stage was a light, bone-jarring mud wagon that left its passengers pretty much exposed to the elements. They could not expect, even with good luck, to arrive at the lumber town of Duncan Mills much before 7 p.m. Oh, my God, they're riding all day that evening. Well, at mid-morning, the stage left the coast, climbed into the mountains past the settlement of Plantation, then turned south again to change horses and have lunch at Henry's Hotel on the Russian River, near where State Highway 128 now exists. Mid-afternoon found them stopping at Myers Grade, several miles south of abandoned Fort Ross, southernmost point of penetration of by Russian traders along the California coast. Passengers, stage driver, and horses were looking forward to the end of the day's long journey when a few turns from the top of the ridge, a flour sack masked man pointed a shotgun at Wilkinson and told him to stop. Now, as in the past robberies, the gunman wore a soiled duster over what appeared to be laborer's clothing. He demanded the Wells Fargo box and the mail bags and made no attempt to rob the driver or passengers. And as the box and mail bags fell from the stage, the gunman motioned the driver to move on. But what proved most startling and intriguing to lawmen and to newsmen, who immediately made the most of it, was the note he left behind, weighted down by a rock atop a roadside stump. On the back of the waybill he had taken from the Wells Fargo Express box, the stage robber had boldly scribbled,
I've labored long for bread, for honor and for riches. But on my corns too long you've tread, you fine-haired sons of bitches. The missive was signed Black Bart the P-O-8, which I would say means the poet. I don't know. I don't know if he considered himself, but it sounded like the poet. Oh, anyway, the massive was signed by Black. Below the four-line stanza, Bart had penned a postscript. Driver, give my respects to our old friend. You know, the other driver. I really had a notion to hang my old disguise hat on his weather eye. Ooh. Hey, each line of the poem and message to the driver had been penned in a different hand, apparently in an attempt to disguise the bandit's true handwriting. Ooh, that guy was quite clever, I'd say. Well, now Wells Fargo's chief of detectives working from his San Francisco office had a name for this wide-ranging stage robber, but he still had little else. Now, to Jim Hume, the situation was frustrating. No one had seen the man's face. He carried a shotgun with which he threatened stage drivers and intimidated passengers, but which he never fired. He apparently traveled cross-country, camping out most of the time, and he traveled on foot. So there was no chance of tracing or identifying him through use of a rental horse or buggy. He apparently preferred the silence of the woods and was well aware that the appearance of a stranger in a backwoods settlement or some crossroads store stirred curiosity and questions. He knew the best way to remain anonymous was simply to remain unseen. Hume sent confidential letters to his company's agents throughout the month, North State, and to all sheriffs and constables seeking information on any suspicious persons they might have seen or heard about moving through their local areas. As in the past, his efforts bore no fruit. Now, the man known as Black Bart did not rob again until 1877 and, in fact, remained inactive until the summer of 1878. Then, on July 25th, just a mile before Berry Creek Sawmill, in addition to relieving the Quincy Orville stage of Wells Fargo & Company's express box and the pouch containing the U.S. Mail, the P-08 again exercised his literary skills, and this time he left the following 8-line verse. Here I lay me down to sleep, to wait the coming morrow. Perhaps success, perhaps defeat, and everlasting sorrow. Let come what will, I'll try it on. My condition can't be worse. And if there's money in that box, 'tis money in my purse. Black Bart, P-O-8, poet. Hey, there were no other deliberate clues found at the robbery scene. But Jim Hume surmised that this bandit was becoming bolder. This time a man had been seen the day before, sitting beside the road at almost the same spot where the robbery occurred. The Wells Fargo detective and local law enforcement men believed it probably was the bandit, checking the time and the stage would arrive at that point. They also determined that the stage robber was no longer taking the precaution of wearing socks or rags wrapped around his boots to hide his footprints. At the robbery scene, they found in the dust clear prints of what appeared to be the size 6 or 8 boot. Now, the 8 lines of doggerel were the last the P-08 would ever leave at a robbery scene, and even though he would commit at least 23 more stage robberies over the next 5.5 years, no more. And taken by the bandit from the express box was $379, considerably more than the little or nothing
Wells Fargo officials told anxious newspaper reporters. Wells Fargo claims only a minor loss appears to be just another indication that the company made a habit of misleading the public about its losses to bandits in order to discourage potential outlaws. Also taken in the Quincy Orville robbery was a $25 silver watch and a $200 diamond ring, which Bart reportedly kept and wore regularly. How much was taken from the U.S. mailbag sacks still remains unknown. But the year 1978 proved a busy one for Black Bart. In addition to the Quincy Orville holdup, just 5 days later, on July 30th, he robbed the LaPorte stage. Then he continued his courteous ways, requesting the driver to please throw down the box. And in removing the mail from its canvas sacks, he continued unknowingly to leave his trademark, the T-shaped slashes, in the mailbags. Observing the T-shaped slash, a Wells Fargo agent said he might just as well have signed his name. If Wells Fargo robbery report is to be believed, his effort garnered only $50 in gold nuggets and another watch. Stage driver Dan Berry said that shortly after sunup, about 6 miles west of LaPorte, a man wearing a duster and a sack with eye holes cut in it stepped from the heavily timbered out roadside in the path of a stage and leveled a shotgun at him. As clouds of dust welled up from the wagon wheels and the milling horses' hooves, Berry pulled his team to a halt. As per the gunman's instruction, the driver tossed out mail sacks and the express box without protest. And, with a wave of his hand, the gunman motioned Berry to go on. Hardly 2 minutes had elapsed between the time Black Bart stepped from the sheltering trees to the time the stage was once more on its way, minus express box and mail sacks. A Plumas County posse, dispatched by Sheriff James H. Yates, found no poetry, and except for tracks in the dust made by about a size 8 boot, no clues. Bart was not heard of again for 3 months. Then, on October 2, and again on October 3, 1878, he pulled off bold robberies, the second of which came close to being the undoing of Black Bart. On the afternoon of October 2nd, about 10 miles north of Ukiah. Hey, that's our area, boy. Mike, he's close to home. Yeah. At a spot ever known as Robber's Rock or Black Bart Rock. Gee, anybody out there know where that is? The flour sack hooded gunman stopped the Arcata Ukiah stage and shielded by a huge boulder that stood at the road's edge. The bandit pointed his shotgun at stage driver Alex Fowler and ordered him to halt. Fowler, who was not accompanied by an armed guard, reportedly was carrying a sawed-off shotgun himself. However, he was given no chance to pull it from the scabbard where it rode beside him. And wisely, he gave up the express box and sacks of mail. Again, the Wells Fargo loss was said to be trifling. The company claimed the express box contained only $40 in a gold watch. At least with 3 watches collected during the recent robberies, Bart was going to be able to tell time. Ha ha, very funny. Well, first, arrivals at the robbery scene found a trampled spot beside the rock and a number of apple cores, indicating the bandit had waited a considerable time for the arrival of the stage. Mendocino County Sheriff James R. Moore arrived from Ukiah, the county seat, but found little except the apple core and the mail sacks with the T-shaped slashes. He returned from the robbery scene the next day, only to find that a few hours early, the Covelo Ukiah stage had been robbed near Centerville on the Potter Valley Road. And although the two robberies had been committed more than 20 miles from each other and something less than 16 hours apart, it appeared from the description given by the passengers. Oh, my goodness. By the passengers and stage drivers, that both holdups, both of them, were the work of the same man. The amount taken in the second robbery was estimated at something in excess of $400. But an exact figure was difficult to determine because the stage had taken on shipments on several small way stations. The bandit did not rob the stage driver, Nathan Waltrip, or his passengers. Now, slits in the mail sacks told the sheriff that the man known as Black Bart had probably committed the October 3rd robbery. Several fresh peach pits found beside the road where the bandit stood indicated that he had breakfast on fruit picked along the way. Sheriff Moore, an accomplished woodsman and tracker, took the bandit's trail, which headed eastward toward Bartlett Springs and Lake County. And for the remainder of that day and throughout the next, Moore riding horseback, but many times dismounting to pick up his quarry's dim track, felt he still had a good chance to catch the fleeing stage robber. Finally, around midday, on October the 5th, after tracking his man nearly 60 miles, Moore gave up when the trail petered out in the grasslands at the edge of the foothills, some 10 miles west of the town of Williams. What also troubled Moore was that he doubted a man on foot could cover that much rough country in such a short time, and he worried that somewhere along the way he had lost the bandit's track and was following some innocent person whose trail had crossed Black Bart's. And meanwhile, as Wells Fargo General Manager John Valentine fumed and James Hume, with increasing frustration, combed his files of known criminals for clues, a man called Charles Bolton was enjoying the good life in San Francisco. This suave, well-groomed gentleman, known to friends as a successful motherlode mine owner and mining engineer, was seen only in the better places with people of good standing, the boulevardier. Always correctly attired, he rants. Always correctly attired, he enjoyed the theater, the city's better music halls, and fine restaurants. And over the years, he had gained a wide circle of friends and acquaintances, including city and police officials. He had become a welcome guest in many San Francisco's better homes. And although he is not known to have forged any serious or lasting female relationships, he was observed on occasion escorting any one of several quite acceptable and eligible matrons whose husbands had passed on. And from his quarters in the Webb House, a well-kept hotel in the Webb Building at 27 Post Street, Bolton ventured forth to enjoy a life of leisure in what was then the West Coast's most prestigious city. He was not a drinking man, and one of his few indulgences was the occasional placing of bets on horse races or prize fights. And from time to time, he would disappear, sometimes for a few days, sometimes for a few weeks. His friends believed he was up in the motherlode, inspecting his mining operations, or involved in a mining engineering project, or for some, client. But upon his return, he might speak briefly on the mining situation, or about mining general in the gold country. But as to his own mine holdings, he always remained sufficiently vague to discourage any details or discussion. People generally construed his reticence to talk about his own mining ventures simply as a reluctance to give away information about a good thing. Well, because he was known as a successful mine owner and mining expert, he occasionally was sought out by friends and, the friends of friends who sought advice on mining stocks or, you know, and gambits for advice. And, well, he usually attempted to sidestep those inquiries. But when pressed, he had a convincing enough store of knowledge and information concerning geology, mining methods, and lore to pass himself off as an expert. An expert with Black Bart, one of our local legends around here, folks. And if you ever think about, see that sign, Black Bart? Well, we're going to tell you all about this guy. The Boulevardier. I'll say that at the end of the station. Boulevardier. I'm getting it. Yes, and we are on KLLG LP 97.9 FM, Willis, California, giving a little bit of our local history on the Bipolar Express with me. You know, few persons who knew him could imagine polite, well-groomed Charles Bolton as anything other than what he said he was. No one in his circle of friends seemed to notice that his absences from the city coincided with some of the mountain area's stage robberies. In fact, in bustling cosmopolitan San Francisco, stage robberies in the hills caused little stir except on the Montgomery Street office of Wells Fargo and Company. Even the doggerel left behind by the bold bandit who signed his work Black Bark, the poet, drew only the temporary interest of Franciscans. Certainly, they had no reason to suspect that one of their own, least of all this suave, mine-owning engineer, could in any way be connected to such a base profession as stage robbery. And not for years would they learn that the stage robber who called himself Black Bart was none other than the respected man they knew as Charles E. Bolton, whose real name, by the way, was Charles Bowles. Now, as Black Bart, this enigmatic man took on a totally opposite character from that of the citified gentleman known to his fellow San Franciscans. Although he preferred and thoroughly enjoyed the amenities of city life, Black Bart was rough, tough of body and mind, and able to withstand the most severe rigors of the outdoors. With the tools of his trade, the shotgun, axe or crowbar for opening express boxes, a bit of food and a change of clothes wrapped in a single blanket, he traveled the back country, avoiding the more well-used roads or trails. Throughout wood, though thoroughly wood-wise, he faced any kind of weather and covered great distances through wilderness or over mountain trails in the space of a few hours. Soon, after committing a stage holdup, he would be miles away, as always using his legs to outdistance the lawmen who were trailing him. His ability to move so swiftly on foot constantly confounded pursuing lawmen. The prime example is his flight from Mendocino County Sheriff James Moore, who, close on Bart's heels, turned back, at least partially because he doubted any individual could have traveled such a distance in so short a period of time. But often, Bart's robberies occurred so many miles apart and within such a short time span that most lawmen, including Wells Fargo special agents, thought they were being committed by two or more men who adopted the flour sack disguise. Now, although the amounts he obtained from its treasure boxes were not large, Black Bart was becoming a very sharp thorn in Wells Fargo's side. Now, Jim Hume's frustration with this elusive highwayman were growing day by day. And the price on Bart's head was also growing. Wells Fargo raised the ante from $250 to $300, and this amount was matched by the state of California. Almost an unprecedented act on the part of that government entity. The U.S. Postal Service Department added another $200 to bring the reward for capture and conviction to a total of $800. Ooh, that's some money. And in fact, that day and age, that amount of money was enticing lure, but it brought no results. One factor weighing heavily in favor of Black Bart was that he had no prior criminal record through which he could be identified as a possible suspect. Although this bandit now had a name, or at least a pseudoname, the law still did not know who he was or very much about him. He left law enforcement officials and Wells Fargo agents groping in the dark. But their dearth of information did not keep local sheriffs or James Hume from speculating. Following the Black Bart robberies of 1877 and 1878, Hume convinced himself that the elusive bandit was the one-eyed Frank Fox, former stage robber who, after serving his several years in San Quentin prison, had been paroled. And following the Ukiah stage robberies in October, the Wells Fargo detective chief mailed a confidential notice to police, sheriff's departments, and Wells Fargo agents throughout the Northern and Central California, listing the P08 robbery suspect as Frank Fox. Well, he described Fox and stated, "From information in my possession, I'm satisfied that one Frank Fox committed the following robberies, and as two of which he left at the scene some doggerel signed Black Bart. Please arrest and said Frank Fox and telegraph me, undersigned or sheriff of Mendocino County." Any old convict who served time in San Quentin when Fox was there will know him. But unknown to Hume, Fox, by that time, had left California, presumably for the Middle West, where he was from originally. And at least he was not arrested, and Hume was spared the embarrassment of having fingered the wrong man. So this show today has been about Black Bart, and I want to say that we will continue the saga of Black Bart on next week's show. And there's more to come. By the way, I'll give you a hint. Black Bart is actually shot twice, once in the head and once in the hand. How exciting is that? There's going to be blood next time. So please, please tune in next week. But right now, I would like to end this show on a light note. What else can it be with you, Gregory? A light note. Well, what about train singers? Oh, well, we'll do one of those, too, if we have enough time. If you don't get too heavy with Gregory. All right, I'm in the background, cranking on my harmonica, which I hope to get to my second song. Okay, in the theme or the spirit of outlawry, here we are singing about another outlaw, far more famous in song. You know, my wife told me, Mike, why don't you write a song about Black Bart? And maybe by my next show, I will have written a song about Black Bart. But right now, I'm going to reach into my pocket and pull out some candy. And I'm going to put it on the counter. I didn't mean to take it out, but I always keep it in there. Okay. This is the song about another famous outlaw called Jesse James, right? You've heard of this guy. Ooh, boy. He was a bad boy, though. Okay, Jesse, where are you? I'm right in front of you, Gregory. I'm right in front of you. Uh-oh. He's only one of them here. Oh, my goodness. It looks like he forgot to get the other seat. I can't believe this. Oh, anyway, here we go. You know what I think I'll do? I'll just do a little bit of Jesse James today and do the rest of it next week. Jesse James was a lad, killed many a man. He robbed at Glendale stage. With the agent on his knees, he delivered up the keys to them outlaws, Frank and Jesse James. Oh, Jesse had a wife who mourned for his life. Three children, they were brave. But that dirty little coward had shot Mr. Howard, and he laid poor Jesse in a grave. Now Jesse and his brother Frank, they robbed that Gallatin bank, carried the money from the town. It was on that very place they had a little race. They shot Captain Sheets to the ground. Now the people held their breath, and they heard of Jesse's death, and wondered how he ever came to fall. Robert Ford, it was a fact that shot Jesse in the back while Jesse hung a picture on the wall. Ooh. Jesse had a wife, mourned for his life, and three children, they were brave. That dirty little town shot Mr. Howard and laid poor Jesse in his grave. Yeah, they laid poor Jesse in his grave. And that's what happened to a lot of those outlaws back in those days. But did not happen to Black Bart. And we're going to talk a little bit about what happened to Black Bart next week. We got a song for time for another little song here, maybe? What do we got? 5 minutes. Yeah, let's just do another one here. Talking about the Glendale stage or the Glendale train. Hey, train singer gets a song. Somebody robbed that Glendale train this morning, 9:30. Somebody robbed that Glendale train, I swear, I ain't lying. Made clean off with 16 G's and left two men lying cold. Somebody robbed that Glendale train and made all bill of gold. Charlie Jones was an engineer, had 20 years on the line. Kissed his wife at the station gate, oh, just about 9. Everything was fine till about 9:30 when Charlie looked up and saw men on horses, men with guns, no sign of the law. Now, somebody robbed that Glendale train this morning, 9:30. Somebody robbed that Glendale train, I swear, oh, I ain't lying. Hey, he made clean off with 16 G's left to men, let go. Somebody robbed that Glendale train and made all a wheel of gold. White, he's the baggest man, oh, he sorely loved his job. The company reward him with a golden watch fob. While Amos White was just a mark in time when the door blew off his car. They found Amos White 15 pieces 15 miles apart. Ooh. That Glendale train, I swear, I ain't lying. Somebody robbed it, Glendale train, I swear, oh, I ain't lying. He may clean off his 16 G's left to man, lying gold. And somebody robbed the Glendale train and made off with the gold. I said, somebody robbed Glendale train and made of highway the gold. Oh boy, don't you like that outlaw feeling? You know, I've been watching this thing on Netflix about Murder Mountain up there in Humboldt County, all them cannabis folks that moved back to the land back in the 70s and had a wonderful lifestyle for a while, but then how greed and all that stuff took over and people began to get murdered instead of getting paid. And then people who were involved in the murder got murdered. And, well, if you're in the outlaw way, it's part of our history right up here in Mendocino. And I'd like to say that next week we're going to continue with that outlaw feeling in this brand new year and read a little bit more about Black Bart and whatever happened to Black Bart. part of your local history. Yeah, that's right. We can cut a little bit of that out. We've been riding on the Bipolar Express. That's right. And we've been following the crazy life of Black Bart. And we're going to be doing this next week, too. And where are we? On KLLG LP 97.9 FM radio. I said KLLG LP 97.9 FM Willis, California. See you next week, Mike. Bring your gun. Doc Lefty.